Welcome to Talking Books on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and in this series I discuss books and what they mean to my guests on the program.
With me in the studio today for Talking Books is Dr. Mark Anthony Faltzon. Just a few words about my guest. Dr. Faltzon read for a degree in social anthropology here in Malta, which he then followed up with his master's and then his PhD at Cambridge. He is senior lecturer here at the University of Malta in the Department of Sociology. He's probably quite well known to listeners as a columnist, a regular columnist in the Sunday Times. Very warm welcome to you, Dr. Faltzon.
Thanks for inviting me.
I have to ask a question which I ask to all of all my guests, and that is how they remember the relationship they had with books when they were young. Obviously, memories don't always match up with exactly how things were, but how do you remember your early years with books?
Yeah. Well, in my case, it's not just memories. I think I have actual physical evidence. I'll explain. Because I've always been very much of a bookworm, but not much of a reader, actually.
Sounds like a contradiction.
Maybe not. But I do love to have books around me all the time. And I spend several hours a day wading through books, etc. But I find it quite hard to pick up a book and read it from cover to cover. Now, what's the physical evidence? When I was young, say 5 or 6, I used to classify my books. So I had come up with a system, a classification system. I don't know if it would work very well for a library. It's rudimentary, I suppose. But I would arrange my books into categories. So you had, ladybird, and then different types of ladybird. And of course, ladybird were already classified because you had the various genres. But I would spend, ages classifying my books and sticking little bits of paper with numbers on them. So I do have some of those books still, and there's physical evidence that this is not just a memory reshaped through years, but I'm sure I actually did that. What I'm trying to come at is when I made the distinction between a bookworm and a reader, books are also a product. Of course, books have content, they're a text, but they're also a product, a physical product. So it's very possible to love books but not be very much of a reader. For example, there are people who have an antiquarian interest in books. They're not necessarily readers, but they love books. And they're ready to spend vast sums of money on books and spend their lives reading up on some edition or other. But they're not necessarily readers, but they're still bookworms in a sense. I know that a bookworm is someone who eats their way through books, a bit like a chain smoker. But in a sense, the original metaphor holds that a bookworm goes through books, but the actual thing, the worm, but doesn't read. The first distinction I would like to draw is between the book as a product, a love for books as products, and now I'll go into some different strands of this, and reading, that is, the actual content. Now, of course,
did you read your Lady Bird books, though? Do you remember reading
them? I think most of those I eventually did, yeah. But first, I classified them, and then I read them. I think, but I do have loads of books at home which I've never read, including some of my favorite books, so-called favorite, which I've never actually read, but they're there, and I treasure them very much. I doubt if I will ever read them. I think my relationship with books, the first aspect of it is this book, the book as a work. As a product, I dare say, as a work of art. Of course, not all books lend themselves to this, but I have here with me, for example, I know it doesn't make much sense to bring props on a radio program,
do describe them, please.
Yes, this is a book on birds. I have quite a few books on birds, actually. It's a book from 1916. It's not worth much, but it's a very beautiful book. So even just holding this book gives me great pleasure. And then when you look at the illustrations, these absolutely gorgeous illustrations, very much turn of the century.
I can assure listeners they are very beautiful.
You see this Japanese influence as well, this foregrounding, foreshortening, etc. So I haven't read this book. It's probably quite a boring book on bird species.
You also have to know French, if I can say.
Le poisson dans la nature. Birds and their habitat, birds in nature. But I'm sure I'll never actually read this book, but it happens to be one of my favorite books because it's such a beautiful thing.
As a book.
As a book, exactly. So, you know, sometimes you hear people making fun of people who are not necessarily readers, but they have their encyclopedia sets in the sitting room. I find that quite acceptable, actually, and quite charming, because books are also a product. They should be beautiful. Now, as I said, this particular one I have here isn't a very good example of that. Medieval illuminated manuscripts, of course, would be a much better example, or maybe books. French books from the 1920s and 1930s, during which time in France there was a huge industry. Well, it was always restricted in a sense because a few aficionados and of book binding. Mm-hmm. And you find books, they're worth loads of money these days, but books with modernist bindings in leather and also some very exotic materials like shark skin, for example, galusha, and also semi-precious stones, etc. That is part of the book. So I find no contradiction between loving the book as a product, as a physical product, and being interested in knowledge, because this is usually the distinction we draw. Someone who is into knowledge, therefore who doesn't really care if the book is Kalf or whatever, and someone who is just interested in books as kind of own. I find no distinction there. My second sort of relationship with books is also books as an arrangement. I told you that I used to classify books, and in a sense I still do. So bookshelves, the way books are arranged, first of all, what sort of titles you have on a bookshelf. So irrespective of whether or not you've read them, but what sort of titles you have on the bookshelf and bookshelves and how they're arranged. That, to me, is a bit like almost like a self-portrait. It's a journal of the person. It's a biography of the person. You could probably say the same of tattoos, I suppose, but I'm more into books than tattoos. I'm not sure the rector would appreciate it if the opposite were the case.
Right.
So the way books are arranged and also the order of books, you don't necessarily have to have thousands of books, even 10 books properly arranged, will say something about the person. So I have quite a fascination with books in that sense as well.
I'm badly thinking of what my bookshelf at home looks like, and I think I'm definitely not going to invite you into my library to analyse me through my book arrangements.
I get very annoyed when people pick a book off my and then put it somewhere else.
Lovely.
I know that sounds a bit, but that's how it is, unfortunately. The third interest I have is it's along sort of the same lines, and that is books that exists in relation with something else. What I'm referring to here is, sort of analytically, the distinction between the museum and the library. Originally, museums and libraries tended to seep into one another. For example, at Oxford, the two big institutions are the Bodleian Library and Ashmolean Museum. These are separate institutions now. The Ashmolean is a museum and the Bodleian is a library. So originally, and when I say originally, I mean until the early 19th century, the Bodleian, the library that is, also had collections of artifacts, stuff, and sometimes very disparate collections. They had a collection of oddities from all over the world, including a Russian lady's whip. I'm not sure about the pedagogical value of that. But curiosities from around. And this was a library. So the Ashmolean had collections of manuscripts. And then in the 19th century, they swapped. So the Bodleian gave the Ashmolean its collections of artifacts, and they swapped. And this is a separation between museum and library. I'm not too keen on that separation. In fact, I like to own books. I like to buy books that relate to some aspect of my actual physical activities or what I actually have physically. So, for example, a couple of years ago, I really got into it. It was a bit of a craze. Japanese prints, 19th century Japanese prints. And I had a couple of Japanese prints. And I also bought pretty much every book I could find on Japanese prints. So I now have the Japanese prints and the set of books that relate to those Japanese prints. So it's not much a matter of a book as, how should I put it, that has a life of its own. As I see it, a book needs to relate to something that's actually very physical. It could be travel as well. So some years back, I went to the Andaman Islands, for example. And when I came back, I bought, again, all the books I could find on the Andaman Islands, on internet, etc. It's become quite easy these days. So there should be, I think, a relation, as I see it, and that's how I live books, in any case, because that was your question. There should be a relation between one's books and one's activities / physical possessions. There should be an interpenetration of function between one's library, and by library I don't mean necessarily, it could be just a bookshelf, one's library, one's books, and the rest of one's life. Now, literature occupies a bit of a strange
category. I was going to say, and the novel?
Exactly. That occupies a bit of a strange category. I find it a bit of a liminal category. There are also bridges. There can be bridges between the bookshelf, that is, the library, and the museum, that is, one's physical notebooks, for example. The notebook, as I see it, is the link between the bookshelf and the museum. So, for example, I have a very keen interest in fishes. Not a gastronomic interest. I observe fishes, and I spend several hours a week actually chasing after fishes and taking notes on fishes. And then I also have lots of books on fishes, and my notebooks are that link between the fishes and my books on fishes, because the notebooks are the fishes I actually see becoming text, but they're not a book, they're not a published book, and the book is text. So the notebook is a kind of bridge between. So my relationship with books is very much on this level. That's why I do a distinction between a bookworm and the reader. I really believe that one's books should relate to other aspects of one's life. Here I'm also referring to that institution, which is not very fashionable these days, the Cabinet of Curiosities. Very much of a European institution. We had one in Malta as well. Gianfrancesco Abela he kept a Cabinet of Curiosities. When I say a cabinet, it was a house in his case, in Marsa, which eventually became sort of the basis for our national collection. But of course, Abela is also well known for having written a book, Della Descrizione di Malta. So you see this interpenetration, this complementarity between text and artifacts, because Abela was a collector of artifacts. He had the archaeological artifacts, also some other curiosities. And the cabinet of curiosities is this institution, I think, the institution that brings together museum and library. Indeed, many of these cabinets of curiosities contain both books and artifacts. I tend to very much sympathize with that. I do not like the distinction between museum and library at all, and I do not want books that do not relate to some physical object.
Well, I must say, listening to you speak sort of gives new meaning to the expression the physicality of books, because you're clearly interested in the smell and the hold of them, not just in the physicality of the words themselves.
No, absolutely. It seems like a contradiction, but we have Kindle on the one hand, which is the electronic reader. We just, I don't have one, but you just apparently download stuff and you can read it off a screen. At the same time, you have publishers like Taschen, for example, doing really large format, beautiful books, sometimes editions of, or not exactly an edition, a reissue of classics like the Atlas Major, for example, in the 17th century. So on the one hand, people are buying electronic text. At the same time, they're buying books as a product, as a beautiful product. So there is this...
There's definitely a dichotomy there somewhere.
There are many historical examples of this. For example, in the 19th century, when mass production really took off, then you also had the arts and crafts movement, which is the counterpoint,
provides the
counterpoint to that. So I don't think I'm alone in definitely not, in loving books as a product as well.
No, absolutely. And you're going to talk to us a little bit, or we're going to discuss a little bit, about three of books, which I can describe as three of your favourite books. Is that would that be a good definition of them?
Yes, probably. I mean, when you asked me to prepare this, I sort of...
So you've thought of
Gulliver's Travels, which is my all-time favorite. That said, I mean, these things, you know, maybe if you ask me in a week's time, I'll tell you something else. But I think Gulliver's Travels has always been with me, and it's something I would love the first edition.
You'd pay a lot for that, would you?
I believe. The first, I think so, but the second, which is 1727 or something, just a year later, is not that expensive, because Gulliver's Travels was an instant hit. So many thousands were published. So it's not necessarily that expensive. In any case, again, I find no contradiction talking about money and books. I mean, I think they go together. I mean,
bought one off eBay. Uh-huh. For me, quite a bit of money, but obviously not for most Militantia people. Uh-huh. I was looking for something else, so I was delighted to be able to spend some money to get a book which I've been harking after for some time.
Exactly. So once you accept, once you can live, you learn to live with the idea that a book is also a product. I mean, one doesn't feel bad that the book also costs money, discussing books and money to return. In any case.
Well, so you also mentioned 1984 and Il Gatto Pardo, the Leopard. I suspect we may not manage to get to the bottom of that list, but let's start off with Gulliver's Travels. What really puts him, Jonathan Swift, at the top of your list?
Well, Gulliver's Travels is a completely extraordinary book, I think. It works on so many levels. That's what makes it so great. It's timeless. It was written in the 18th century. It's very much a political satire of British politics at the time. But it still reads so well. Now let's explore some of these levels. First of all, the descriptions, Swift's imagination. I think the original book title was Travels into Several Remote Nations of the World. So this is a travelogue. It's a parody. It's a parody of a travelogue of travel literature. Nothing terribly new about that. Parodies of travel literature have existed for probably actually many, many hundreds of years. A couple of thousand, actually. And at the time when Swift wrote this, early 18th century, travel was, of course, all the rage, and there were lots of travel. There was lots of travel writing being published. And so Gulliver's Travels is a parody, it's a satire of travel fiction. One thing that I think travel fiction needs to transmit is a sense of fascination with difference, with diversity. And Swift does this incredibly well. I mean, the things he conjures up are absolutely extraordinary, worthy of Italo Calvino, I think. The Flying Island, for example, the differences, absolutely fantastic. So that's why children love it so much.
Of course.
Because it's a world of imagination. I'm not implying that imagination should be restricted to children, but that's probably what Weber's Iron Cage does to us. In fact, for example, a film director like Terry Gilliam, that's one of his ideas, that we need to produce art that defies rationality, really. But let's not go into film. So I think Gulliver's Travels is first and foremost a wonderfully readable and entertaining book. It's a good travel story. I mean, at first, it looks like a normal travelogue, but after a couple of pages, you realize that
something
this is
funny
not
going
serious.
On.
Exactly. It's also extremely funny. It's howlingly funny. Some sections of this book, I mean, they are just so funny, and that's great. I mean, so the humor, the satire is very well done, I think. But then there are also other aspects to Gulliver's Travels. Now, I'm an anthropologist, so one of the things we engage with is scale, for example. When one travels in space, possibly in time as well, one encounters differences of scale, for example. And the first two places that Gulliver visits, they're all about scale. So first he visits a place where everyone is small, and therefore there is the implication of pettiness as well. The world as a small place, almost a petty place. The second destination is the land of giants, and that's a different take. That's almost grotesque scale. So we have the same thing, humanity, but seen from two very, very different perspectives, which is, and both are right, and that's the great thing about this book. This book presents at least four different perspectives of humanity, but it doesn't present any one of these four as the right one. It's a plurivocal book, different voices, different takes on human nature, etc. I'm leaving apart the satire, the British political satire, etc., because I think that would take us. But of course, there is that aspect as well. It's very, very strong in the book, actually. There are also some satirical bits that are closer to home, in a sense, definitely at Campus FM. For example, when he was referring to the Royal Society, but I'm sure you could apply this to a modern university. So, for example, chapter 5, he describes his visit to the Grand Academy of Lagado. This is a bit like a university, actually. We have people men mostly, engaged in really esoteric and arcane experiments. So the first chap he comes across, he had been 8 years upon a project for extracting sunbeams out of cucumbers. So clearly, not obviously a non-starter. And this is a really great parody, a satire of what we do at university, I suppose. I don't know. I've written a book on multi-sided ethnography. Who cares? So there is the serious side to that. I mean, I hope, some people do, and some people buy it and all that, and it's a contribution. But at the same time, who cares? So this book invites us to take ourselves not so seriously and to keep a sense of humor about what we do. But the great thing is that even while Swift parodies human nature and he also parodies misanthropy. And I think that's one of the biggest contributions of that. That's what makes it so. So even as Gulliver visits these places and is completely, he ends up very upset and very disillusioned about humanity. The last sentence is, I think, a masterpiece.
Will you read it for us?
Well, okay. I mean, I'm
to finish off the program.
Exactly Guinness, but I'm here. And therefore I here entreat those who have any tincture of this absurd vice, he's referring to pride, that they will not presume to appear in my sight. So he's saying, proud people should not appear in my sight. I won't have anything to do with them. But that itself is pride. So he is constructing this incredible parody of pride, of conceit, of misanthropy. So this is a person, fictional character, who has a certain revulsion for the human race. At the same time, the author is parodying this person and bringing out the charm of the, also using humor. So it's a great book. It's a really fantastic book.
I'm sure that your description is going to send everybody scurrying back to their bookshelves to pick it out again. And the other two books on your list will have to be for another program. Thank you very, very much, Dr. Mark Anthony Falzon, for coming on the program today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to Talking Books. I hope you can join us next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.